252, Chapters 5 and 6 of Gulliver's Travels. Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from the shores of the Potomac in Virginia, the Old Dominion. Episode 252, Sacre Bleu. This week's episode is brought to you by Knit Circus, the e-newsletter that can arrive in your mailbox delivering three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can sign up at www.knitcircus.com. And SeedPod Publishing, a micro-publisher cooperative. We publish books, not for their value as products, but for their value. Any questions? And Little Acorn Creations, handmade accessories for heart and home. Today's show is also brought to you by Audible. Please visit audiblepodcast.com/craftlit for your free audiobook download. Greetings and salutations.
How are you?
I am in a really goofy mood today, so I'm not entirely sure where this is going to go, but life is exciting and interesting, and, you know, I'm just kind of glad to be still living it. It's been a hairy couple of weeks, but I do have some interesting news to share with you. The first is the podcast title. I have mentioned books by this author before, with the caveat that they are not for children. He is a bawdy writer. He is sometimes a kind of offensive author, but he is always an interesting and uniquely visioned author. I think that's safe to say. I am reading the new book by Christopher Moore. Now, you know I love Jasper Ford, and Jasper Ford is spectacularly creative. Well, Christopher Moore is spectacularly creative in other ways. The first time he came across my radar was with a book called Lamb, the Lost Gospel of Jesus According to His Best Friend Biff, or something like that, which is a shockingly reverent book in many ways. Jesus is really a wonderful character, and Biff is the guy who gets to do all the other stuff. And by the end, I mean, you know the end, right? You know what's coming. And it doesn't matter. You are absolutely weeping through the last chapter of the book. And I figure if this kind of bawdy, irreverent writer can provoke that kind of emotion from you, he's really got something by the horns. Well, then I read his book, actually listened to the Audible version of the book Fool by him. And Fool is his take on King Lear. And at first I was kind of freaked out because he changes the story of Lear considerably, at least the end of the story of Lear considerably. And then he has this long, detailed afterword where he explains that this was actually kind of a known tradition of changing, especially with Lear, the end of plays, Shakespeare plays in particular, and that this was kind of an accepted, almost like a game, you know, that people would go, hey, what would happen if Cordelia came back? What would happen if? And so you wind up learning an awful lot while being entertained an awful lot and getting a really fascinating character's voice kind of stuck in your head. And it's marvelous. And it wasn't stuck in my head just because the Audible version was marvelous, but because the main character was so compelling and it was told from the point of view of the fool. Now, between Lamb and Fool, I read his vampire books, You Suck, A Love Story, and Bloodsucking Fiends, both of which are hilarious, and also tie in and overlap with another book called A Dirty Job, which I thought was really interesting because I didn't see it coming. For a while, I was just grabbing all of the audiobooks I could of Christopher Moore's because they're a lot of fun to listen to, especially if read well, and the audiobook versions are read quite well. Well, his latest one, I am not listening to an audio. I'm listening to something else as an audiobook, but his new book, Sacre Bleu, is fascinating. And I am sure that half of it is absolutely untrue. And you'll be able to tell which part is untrue. But he's woven a lot of really interesting history, just like he did with Lamb, just like he did with Fool, really interesting history into this otherwise kind of fanciful tale and tragic and heartbreaking tale in some parts. And it's all about the color blue, this very specific pigment ground from lapis lazuli, and then mixed with, you know, linseed oil and this, that, and the other thing, and treated with all these other chemicals. And eventually you wind up with the pure pigment that painters used for Mary's colors. At some point, now I don't remember this part of the book because I was laughing too hard at a different part, and I think it erased my memory of this part. But there was some kind of an edict or some kind of a generalized rule that if you were going to paint Mary, the Mother of God, you would use this particular pigment of blue. As soon as somebody said that to me, I was like, oh, that color blue, because I think we've probably all seen it at some point. Well, Christopher Moore has taken that piece of information, which is true, and woven this incredible, warped, fascinating tale around it. And as often as he can put vulgarities into the mouths of his characters, and he will, he also, there's a scene where the painter Manet, is dying. And the scene that Christopher Moore wrote is so heartbreakingly beautiful that it actually brought tears to my eyes. I mean, it's just lovely. And, you know, when the man wants to write, the man can write. It's just so much fun to read his books. So I have not checked out the Audible version of Sacre Bleu, but I am not averse to doing so. It would be, even though I'm reading it in paper, I think I would actually like to listen to it again because it's a world I don't really want to leave yet, and I'm nearing the end. So, you know, no affiliation, yada yada, but I thought you might be interested because it is such a fascinating cross-section of time, you know, the late 1800s in Paris and everything that's going on. It's Van Gogh and Vincent Van Gogh, Theo Van Gogh. Toulouse-Lautrec is a main character, and he is fabulously written. Oh, you just want to run off with the guy. He's a marvelous character. What I am listening to on Audible is, you guys remember The Time Traveler's Wife that came out years ago? That same writer, Audrey Niffenegger, she wrote a book called Her Fearful Symmetry. I just cannot say that quickly. Her Fearful Symmetry. The reader is marvelous. And the book is haunting. It's got the same feel that the 1Q84 has, but it's a ghost story set in Highgate Cemetery. And I, having gone from Time Traveler's Wife, which is marvelous, to this, which is marvelous in a different way, you know, you kind of expect the books to be similar. Audrey Niffenegger is such an amazing writer. There's no crossover between the two books. You can't go into the second one thinking it's going to be like the first, because it's just not. It is, in fact, a fairly twisted love story, but fascinating. And so, you know, lots of good stuff to listen to, along with Gulliver's Travels. It's an embarrassment of riches, is what I'm saying. So there are my completely unasked for plugs for books that, you know, take it or leave it. But I don't know about you. I'm always looking for some new book that will capture me. And life is so busy. The audiobook format, just like the podcast format, I find really helpful and useful. And I have, you know, my few podcasts that are my go-to podcasts that I will always listen to. And oh my gosh, are you listening to Richard II on Chop Bard? If not, go back and pick it up. I didn't realize how much beautiful writing done by Shakespeare is in that particular play. Really famous lines that you've heard, although not usually heard connected to the play. They're the quotes that get taken out of context and used by people the sceptered isle and things like that, and let us sit on the ground and speak of the death of kings, or I did that one wrong, but wow, Richard II. I can really see why Aaron Ziegler was excited about doing Richard II. If you haven't checked out that podcast yet, what's stopping you? Well, and in the search for good books on audio, our first real, we've gotten PayPal subjugated. We kicked PayPal's butt. Everything is now working for the subscription, and it will bounce you back. You have to click return to merchant page or something like that, and it will return you to the correct page on the website where you can sign up for the newsletter. And the newsletter is how you will get your subscriber little goodies sent to you. And this weekend, we will be sending out our first real one. There should have been a confirmation email that came out with the link to the cheddar pattern. This week, there will be a link to a new pattern for Wensleydale, Cheddar's little friend, and there will be a link for you to download the first chapter of the audiobook version of Cool for Cats. So that'll be coming out kind of like a Charles Dickens novel. We're going to shoot for every week, and it'll be the next chapter, just like Craftlit does, but it'll just be the book, and maybe a little jazz. We're working on the jazz for you. So if you are interested in subscribing to the show, go to the show notes at craftlit.com. Look in the right-hand column. There's a place to sign up for just the regular newsletter. And if you sign up for the subscriber newsletter, you don't have to sign up for both. There's the link for the regular newsletter, which is free and available to everyone. There's a space for just donating. And then underneath that is the subscribe button. And that button is the one to use if you want to subscribe to Craftlit and Just the Books and get all the little goodies that we'll be sending out forever now. It's like marriage. I've committed to this. Somebody once told me that mortgage was a scarier M word than marriage. And these days, I think that actually might be true. I don't know how I just remembered that. Oh, and don't forget, if you donate to the show in any form whatsoever during the month of May 2012, you will be put into the running for your very own Madame Defarge pack, Political Action Committee t-shirt, the Don't Lose Your Head shirt. And people always do a double take when I wear mine out. It's kind of wonderful because people go, ah, yeah, that sums it up, doesn't it? All right, I have a quick little plug to do for a book. This is a knitting book now, and I know that this is, it's been featured in the Knit Picks magazine, because I saw the cover, I thumbed through the Knit Picks catalog super fast, but I did notice this one. This is Knitting with Two Colors, Techniques for Stranded Knitting and Designing Color-Patterned Garments. This is by Meg Swanson and Amy Detchen, and you may recall, Amy Detchen is a friend of the show, and also on the Knit Circus podcast with Jala. And how can I describe the marvelousness of Amy Detchen? I keep getting to see her at trade shows like Rhinebeck and then at Maryland Sheep and Wool. And she is just one of those people who exudes love. And therefore, you love her back. And it's marvelous. She and Meg Swanson put together a spectacular book with a lot of humor and a lot of heart, which is what you would expect from, you know, Meg Swanson, daughter of Elizabeth Zimmerman. You would kind of expect that. But, you know, Elizabeth Zimmerman, some people were very frustrated with her books because she didn't really provide patterns. She provided recipes and kind of suggestions. Knit around until it's long enough, then start decreasing at regular intervals. You know, and that might not help you if you're a brand new knitter. Well, if you are a beginning or even an intermediate knitter, or heck, even if you're an advanced knitter, you might find stuff in here to be really helpful. They go over all of the techniques you would need in clear, really clear pictures, photographs, and very, very easy to follow charts. And they do such a lovely job of kind of taking you through the process step by step. And then also putting in these photographs that are absolutely inspirational. It just makes you want to go grab yarn and needles and make beautiful things. And I mean, and the technique stuff even goes into how to cast on with multiple colors, different ways. And then garment construction. And this is where, for the intermediate or advanced knitter, I think the book becomes a godsend. Because there are patterns of Miss Zimmerman's that I loved very much, but I never really wanted to attack. I'm thinking particularly of the, I think they were the Moroccan socks that had all the stripiness on the back and the stripiness on the heel and the really cool fitted arch and all of that stuff. I was willing to figure out the fitted arch, but I have to admit, I was kind of freaked by the stranded color work and the potential for me to make the sock far too small for my foot or the foot of anyone else I know other than maybe my children. And they do such a lovely job of taking you through all of the steps and making it not scary. And I so respect that. Now that I've been writing more patterns, I realize just how extraordinarily difficult it is to write something that happens in three dimensions and write it out in an explanatory fashion on a two-dimensional sheet of paper. It's really ridiculously hard, and they do a great job. So this book, Knitting with Two Colors, is available pretty much everywhere you find knitting books these days. And it's out from Schoolhouse Press. And I will put a link in the show notes so that you can take a gander yourself. But it's a small book. You will be surprised when you see it. It's only like 70 pages long. It's a small book, but like everything from Schoolhouse Press, it is packed with juicy information. And it's fun to read. And, you know, light summer reading as you read about wool. Not a bad way to spend your time. So there, new knitting book, very exciting stuff. So happy to be able to pass that on to you. I was originally going to have an interview this week with Tara of the new book Market Yourself, Tara Swiger, and the fates conspired against us, and it's probably just as well because this week has been nutty and I don't think I would have been able to edit the audio, but there will be an interview with Tara coming up in the next podcast or so. Very excited about that. And I think it's time to move on to Gulliver, don't you? Well, this week I am happy to say we get down and dirty with the satire. Its time has come, and a good thing too. You are going to hear Jonathan Swift say things that sound so modernly egalitarian, you will stop what you're doing while you're listening. And you will hear him say things about women and women's education that, again, you'll go, wow, really? This is like 1726? And this guy is getting away with saying that? And of course, he's getting away with saying that because he's talking about Lilliput. He's not talking about our world. And so it's okay for them. And that's one of the brilliant things about how he set up this particular satire. Because it would seem that there are really two ways to approach the writing of political satire. One is that you can create an alternate society that is very similar to yours, but shown to be so contemptible within the framework that you've set up that everybody can point to it and go, oh my gosh, look at that, and not really realizing that they're pointing at themselves. So that's one way you can do it. The other way you can do it is to set up another society that is so amazingly good that its goodness points fingers back at our society. And the interesting thing is that Jonathan Swift allows himself to use both of those techniques all the way through this book. And he can get away with it because of Gulliver. Gulliver, who is such a simple person, who only takes things at face value, who, when this tiny 6-inch king decides to honor him with attention, he is so over the moon at having royalty pay attention to him, regardless of how small and insignificant that royalty might be, that we can see Swift pointing and going, do you get this? The royalty thing doesn't matter. It's silly. It's ridiculous. And he went through this particularly unpleasant change in power between Queen Anne, and who's a Tory, and George the First, who didn't even speak English and was a Whig. And that transfer of power was not, it didn't fall down the way that he had hoped. And during all of that time, Queen Anne and into George, there was the War of Spanish Succession. Secession, I need to say that correctly. And really what it was is Spain and France are very close. They're both Catholic countries. They're both very close. And they shared some royal blood. And there was some discussion at that point about whether they should join forces and become one big country, which, of course, would have thrown the balance of power way off in Europe. And the other European rulers were like, the heck you're going to do that? And so you got a war. Interestingly enough, and remember, this is the early 1700s, the Tories wanted to wage war on the ocean. They wanted to send the Navy out. Think back to Persuasion and Jane Austen and the rise of the naval class. All right, once you had Sir Francis Drake sinking the Spanish Armada back with Elizabeth, you get this kind of constantly growing reliance upon the English Navy. The Tories really wanted to stick with the Navy because it meant fewer casualties and because their Navy was particularly good. And so they were seeing this as a way to, sure, we can be involved in the war, but we aren't going to lose as many people. The Whigs wanted to do land campaigns. And one of the people who was famous in this war was a little man named Churchill. Yes. Who became, because of this, eventually became the Duke of Marlborough. And one of his first battles was the Battle of Blenheim. And if you've been to Blenheim Castle in England, you know that that is the Churchill estate. Blenheim Castle was named for the place of his first campaign where he won. And that is all of that wrapped up in a nutshell. However, the Tories were in power at the beginning of the war. The Whigs were in power at the end of the war. In the middle was the Treaty of Utrecht. And that was where Swift's friends, Oxford and Bolingbroke, got nailed for having made what they thought was a fair treaty and what the Whigs thought was not treaty enough, in that it didn't punish the other side nearly as much as they would have liked. So just like we're having, you know, modern day technology conversations about war, what's the best way to fight a war? How do we do it? How do we minimize casualties on our side? They were having the same conversation. Exactly the same conversation. How do you use technology? What's the best way to do it? How can we minimize casualties? All of that was happening in early 1700s. So one thing to listen for as we continue through the novel, and this will be true for the entire book, is when Gulliver starts off by saying, in my own dear country, prick up your ears because he's about to insult England. Something about someone or some place or some feature or some political justification is going to come out of his mouth, and it's going to be a dig aimed back at his homeland, at Swift's homeland. Now, one text that affected Swift quite a lot was Plato's Republic. And between that and his own kind of utopian views of how things should be, and in many ways, he's arguing to go back to a better day, but at the same time, you're going to hear him saying things that are so forward-thinking and modern that it's going to surprise you. Every once in a while in the satire, you're going to hear him say something and you'll go, really? Huh. Okay. And like promoting this idea that evidently was part of Athens too, that state offices, governmental offices, were held by lottery. So you weren't actually getting someone who was best for the job, necessarily. Not that you're necessarily getting the person who's best for the job, even when you're voting for them, but that the process was far more arbitrary, which meant that you wouldn't have lobbyists and political jockeying and people getting paid off and stuff like that. So in some ways, that does solve one problem that we see with our current system in the United States. But it's also kind of a fairly utopian view of people and their ability to rise to the occasion, as it were. And it's interesting to me because he seems to be, I think, kind of presaging the rise of the Enlightenment. And from here, we start to get, you know, Locke and Hobbes and Rousseau and all of the people who are writing towards the middle and end of Swift's century. And so it's kind of cool because you can see the roots of it here in Gulliver, which is kind of nifty, I think. Okay, there's one word I'm going to tell you about, and then everything else I'm going to go over with you, I'll do on the flip side. But at one point, the emperor is going to give Gulliver a title. You know, he's not giving him money. He's not giving him power. He's just giving him a name. And that name is Nardak. And it's a big deal to Gulliver. It's, you know, it's like, I dub thee Sir Gulliver. Whoa, that's so awesome. He's so excited. Well, Nardak is a dig. And the Nar part is German for fool. And Dak is, one of the theories is that Dak is close to Duke. And this is his dig at Churchill, being made Duke of Marlborough for his victories in the land war. Victories that were sure he won, but they were not decisive. They did not change the course of the war, and they didn't make the war end any sooner. And so this is, people think this is probably a little dig of his, but it is also, I think, important to notice just how jazzed Gulliver is about these little things. You know, it's the gold star thing. It's you know, giving a kid a gold star for showing up. You know, it's like, hey, you're breathing, A+. Kids know that's garbage. Gulliver doesn't. So it's kind of fun to watch him respond to his treatment by the emperor. I'm going to play 5 and 6 for you back to back. The end of 6 ends with one of the most ridiculous setups ever. And if you're paying attention, you will probably laugh out loud at how completely stupid the Lilliputians are at that point. It's awesome. And it is, in fact, based on a true story. So I'll let you know that on the end. In the meantime, I will leave you in the capable hands of Aaron Ziegler, who will be reading chapters 5 and 6 of Gulliver's Travels.
Chapter 5. The author, by an extraordinary stratagem, prevents an invasion. A high title of honor is conveyed upon him. Ambassadors arrive from the Emperor of Blefuscu and sue for peace. The Empress's apartment on fire by an accident, the author instrumental in saving the rest of the palace. The Empire of Blefuscu is an island situated to the north-northeast side of Lilliput, from whence it is parted only by a channel of 800 yards wide. I had not yet seen it, and upon this notice of an intended invasion, I avoided appearing on that side of the coast for fear of being discovered by some of the enemy's ships, who had received no intelligence of me, all intercourse between the two empires having been strictly forbidden during the war upon pain of death, and an embargo laid by our emperor upon all vessels whatsoever. I communicated to His Majesty a project I had formed of seizing the enemy's whole fleet, which, as our scouts assured us, lay at anchor in the harbor ready to sail with the first fair wind. I consulted the most experienced seamen upon the depth of the channel, which they had often plumbed, who told me that in the middle at high water it was 70 glumgluffs deep, which is about 6 foot of European measure, and the rest of it 50 glumgluffs at most. I walked to the northeast coast over against Blefuscu, where, lying down behind a hillock, I took out my small pocket perspective glass and viewed the enemy's fleet at anchor, consisting of about 50 men of war and a great number of transports. I then came back to my house and gave order, for which I had a warrant, for a great quantity of the strongest cable and bars of iron. The cable was about as thick as pack thread, and the bars of the length and size of a knitting needle. I trebled the cable to make it stronger, and for the same reason I twisted 3 of the iron bars together, binding the extremities into a hook. Having thus fixed 50 hooks to as many cables, I went back to the northeast coast, and putting off my coat, shoes, and stockings, walked into the sea in my leather jerkin about 30 minutes before high water. I waded with what haste I could, and swam in the middle about 30 yards until I felt the ground. I arrived to the fleet in less than 30 minutes. The enemy was so frightened when they saw me that they leapt out of their ships and swam to shore, where there could not be fewer than 30,000 souls. I then took my tackling, and fastening a hook to the hole at the prow of each, I tied all the cords together at the end. While I was thus employed, the enemy discharged several thousand arrows, many of which stuck in my hands and face, and besides the excessive smart, gave me much disturbance in my work. The greatest apprehension was for mine eyes, which I should have infallibly lost if I had not suddenly thought of an expedient. I kept, among other little necessities, a pair of spectacles in a private pocket, which, as I observed before, had escaped the emperor's searches. These I took out and fastened as strongly as I could upon my nose, and thus armed, went on boldly with my work in spite of the enemy's arrows, many of which struck against the glasses of my spectacles, but without any other effect further than a little to discompose them. I had now fastened all the hooks, and taking the knot in my hand, began to pull. But not a ship would stir, for they were all too fast held by their anchors, so that the boldest part of my enterprise remained. I therefore let go the cord, and leaving the hooks fixed to the ships, I resolutely cut with my knife the cables that fastened the anchors, receiving above 200 shots in my face and hands. Then I took up the knotted end of the cables to which my hooks were tied, and with great ease drew 50 of the enemy's largest men of war after me. The Blefuscudians, who had not the least imagination of what I intended, were at first confounded with astonishment. They had seen me cut the cables, and thought my design was only to let the ships run adrift or fall foul on each other. But when they perceived the whole fleet moving in order and saw me pulling at the end, they set up such a scream of grief and despair that it is almost impossible to describe or conceive. When I had got out of danger, I stopped a while to pick out the arrows that stuck in my hands and face, and rubbed on some of the same ointment that was given me at my first arrival, as I have formerly mentioned. I then took off my spectacles, and waiting about an hour until the tide was a little fallen, I waded through the middle with my cargo, and arrived safe at the royal port of Lilliput. The emperor and his whole court stood on the shore, expecting the issue of this great adventure. They saw the ships moving forward in a large half-moon, but could not discern me, who was up to my breast in water. When I advanced to the middle of the channel, they were yet more in pain, because I was under water to my neck. The emperor concluded me to be drowned, and that the enemy's fleet was approaching in a hostile manner. But he was soon eased of his fear, for the channel growing shallower every step I made, I came in a short time within hearing, and holding up the end of the cable by which the fleet was fastened, I cried in a loud voice, "Long live the most puissant emperor of Lilliput!" This great prince received me at my landing with all possible encomiums, and created me a Nardak upon the spot, which is the highest title of honor among them. His Majesty desired I would take some other opportunity to bring in all the rest of his enemy's ships into his port. And so unmeasurable is the ambition of princes, that he seemed to think of nothing less than reducing the whole empire of Blefuscu into a province, and governing it by a viceroy, of destroying the big Endian exiles, and compelling that people to break the smaller end of their eggs, by which he would remain sole monarch of the whole world. But I endeavored to divert him from this design by many arguments drawn from the topics of policy as well as justice, and I plainly protested that I would never be an instrument of bringing a free and brave people into slavery. And when the matter was debated in council, the wisest part of the ministry were of my opinion. This open, bold declaration of mine was so opposite to the schemes and politics of His Imperial Majesty that he could never forgive me. He mentioned it in a very artful manner at council, where I was told that some of the wisest appeared, at least by their silence, to be of my opinion. But others, who were my secret enemies, could not forbear some expressions which by a side wind reflected on me, and from this time began an intrigue between His Majesty and a junta of ministers maliciously bent against me, which broke out in less than 2 months, and had like to have ended in my utter destruction. Of so little weight are the greatest services to princes when put into the balance with the refusal to gratify their passions. About 3 weeks after this exploit, there arrived a solemn embassy from Blefuscu with humble offers of a peace, which was soon concluded upon conditions very advantageous to our emperor, wherewith I shall not trouble the reader. There were 6 ambassadors with a train of about 500 persons, and their entry was very magnificent, suitable to the grandeur of their master and the importance of their business. When their treaty was finished, wherein I did them several good offices by the credit I now had, or at least appeared to have at court, their excellencies, who were privately told how much I had been their friend, made me a visit in form. They began with many compliments upon my valor and generosity, invited me to that kingdom in the emperor their master's name, and desired me to show them some proofs of my prodigious strength, of which they had heard so many wonders, wherein I readily obliged them, but shall not interrupt the reader with the particulars. When I had for some time entertained their excellencies to their infinite satisfaction and surprise, I desired they would do me the honor to present my most humble respects to the emperor their master, the renown of whose virtues had so justly filled the whole world with admiration, and whose royal person I resolved to attend before I returned to my own country. Accordingly, the next time I had the honor to see our emperor, I desired his general license to wait on the Blefuscudian monarch, which he was pleased to grant me, as I could plainly perceive, in a very cold manner, but could not guess the reason, until I had a whisper from a certain person that Flimnap and Bolglam had represented my intercourse with those ambassadors as a mark of dissatisfaction, from which I am sure my heart was wholly free. And this was the first time I began to conceive some imperfect idea of courts and ministers. It is to be observed that these ambassadors spoke to me by an interpreter, the languages of both empires differing as much from each other as any two in Europe, and each nation priding itself upon the antiquity, beauty, and energy of their own tongues with an avowed contempt for that of their neighbor. Yet our emperor, standing upon the advantage he had got by the seizure of their fleet, obliged them to deliver their credentials and make their speeches in the Lilliputian tongue. And it must be confessed that from the great intercourse of trade and commerce between both realms, from the continual reception of exiles, which is mutual among them, and from the custom in each empire to send their young nobility and richer gentry to the other in order to polish themselves by seeing the world and understanding men and manners, there are few persons of distinction, or merchants or seamen who dwell in the maritime parts, but what can hold conversations in both tongues. As I found some weeks after, when I went to pay my respects to the Emperor of Blefuscu, which in the midst of great misfortunes through the malice of my enemies proved a very happy adventure to me, and I shall relate in its proper place. The reader may remember that when I signed those articles upon which I recovered my liberty, there were some which I disliked upon the account of their being too servile. Neither could anything but an extreme necessity have forced me to submit. But being now a Nardac of the highest rank in that empire, such offices were looked upon as below my dignity, and the emperor, to do him justice, never once mentioned them to me. However, it was not long before I had an opportunity of doing his majesty, at least as I then thought, a most signal service. I was alarmed at midnight with the cries of many hundred people at my door, by which, being suddenly awaked, I was in some kind of terror. I heard the word burglum repeated incessantly. Several of the emperor's court, making their way through the crowd, entreated me to come immediately to the palace, where Her Imperial Majesty's apartment was on fire by the carelessness of a maid of honor who fell asleep while she was reading a romance. I got up in an instant, and orders being given to clear the way before me, and it being likewise a moonshine night, I made a shift to get to the palace without trampling on any of the people. I found they had already applied ladders to the walls of the apartment, and were well provided with buckets, but the water was at some distance. These buckets were about the size of a large thimble, and the poor people supplied me with them as fast as they could, but the flame was so violent that they did little good. I might easily have stifled it with my coat, which I unfortunately left behind me for haste, and came away only in my leather jerkin. The case seemed wholly desperate and deplorable, and this magnificent palace would have infallibly been burnt down to the ground if, by a presence of mind unusual to me, I had not suddenly thought of an expedient. I had the evening before drank plentifully of a most delicious wine called Glimmergrim. The Blefuscudians call it Fluneck, but ours is esteemed the better sort, which is very diuretic. By the luckiest chance in the world, I had not discharged myself of any part of it. The heat I had contracted by coming very near the flames, and by my laboring to quench them, made the wine begin to operate by urine, which I voided in such a quantity and applied so well to the proper places that in 3 minutes the fire was wholly extinguished, and the rest of that noble pile which had cost so many ages in erecting preserved from destruction. It was now daylight, and I returned to my house without waiting to congratulate with the Emperor, because although I had done a very eminent piece of service, yet I could not tell how His Majesty might resent the manner by which I had performed it. For by the fundamental laws of the realm, it is capital in any person of what quality soever to make water within the precincts of the palace. But I was a little comforted by a message from His Majesty that he would give orders to the Grand Judiciary for passing my pardon in form, which, however, I could not obtain, and I was privately assured that the Empress, conceiving the greatest abhorrence of what I had done, removed to the most distant side of the court, firmly resolved that those buildings should never be repaired for her use, and in the presence of her chief confidence, could not forbear vowing revenge. Chapter 6. Of the Inhabitants of Lilliput, Their Learning, Laws, and Customs, The Manner of Educating Their Children, The Author's Way of Living in That Country, His Vindication of a Great Lady. Although I intend to leave the description of this empire to a particular treatise, yet in the meantime I am content to gratify the curious reader with some general ideas. As the common size of the natives is somewhat under 6 inches, so there is an exact proportion in all other animals, as well as plants and trees. For instance, the tallest horses and oxen are between 4 and 5 inches high, the sheep an inch and a half more or less, their geese about the bigness of a sparrow, and so the several gradations downward till you come to the smallest, which to my sight were almost invisible. But nature hath adapted the eyes of the Lilliputians to all objects proper for their view. They see with great exactness, but at no great distance. And to show the sharpness of their sight towards objects that are near, I have been much pleased with observing a cook pulling a lark, which was not so large as a common fly, and a young girl threading an invisible needle with invisible silk. Their tallest trees are about 7 foot high, I mean some of those in the great royal park, the tops whereof I could but just reach with my fist clenched. The other vegetables are in the same proportion, but this I leave to the reader's imagination. I shall say but little at present of their learning, which for many ages hath flourished in all its branches among them. But their manner of writing is very peculiar, being neither from the left to the right, like the Europeans, nor from the right to the left, like the Arabians, nor from up to down, like the Chinese, nor from down to up, like the Cascadians, but aslant, from one corner of the paper to the other, like ladies in England. They bury their dead with their heads directly downward, because they hold an opinion that in 11,000 moons they are all to rise again, in which period the earth, which they conceive to be flat, will turn upside down, and by this means they shall, at their resurrection, be found ready standing on their feet. The learned among them confess the absurdity of this doctrine, but the practice still continues in compliance to the vulgar. There are some laws and customs in this empire very peculiar, and if they were not so directly contrary to those of my own dear country, I should be tempted to say a little in their justification. It is only to be wished that they were as well executed. The first I shall mention relateth to informers. All crimes against the state are punished here with the utmost severity. But if the person accused make his innocence plainly to appear upon his trial, the accuser is immediately put to an ignominious death, and out of his goods or lands, the innocent person is quadruply recompensed for the loss of his time, for the danger he underwent, for the hardship of his imprisonment, and for all the charges he hath been at in making his defense. or if that fund be deficient, it is largely supplied by the crown. The emperor doth also confer on him some public mark of his favor, and proclamation is made of his innocence through the whole city. They look upon fraud as a greater crime than theft, and therefore seldom fail to punish it with death, for they allege that care and vigilance with a very common understanding may preserve a man's goods from thieves, but honesty hath no fence against superior cunning. And since it is necessary that there should be a perpetual intercourse of buying and selling and dealing upon credit, where fraud is permitted or connived at or hath no law to punish it, the honest dealer is always undone, and the knave gets the advantage. I remember when I was once interceding with the king for a criminal who had wronged his master of a great sum of money, which he had received by order and ran away with, and happening to tell his majesty, by way of extenuation, that it was only a breach of trust, the emperor thought it monstrous in me to offer, as a defense, the greatest aggravation of the crime. And truly, I had little to say in return, farther than the common answer that different nations had different customs, for, I confess, I was heartily ashamed. Although we usually call reward and punishment the two hinges upon which all government turns, yet I could never observe this maxim to be put in practice by any nation except that of Lilliput. Whoever can there bring sufficient proof that he hath strictly observed the laws of his country for 73 moons, hath a claim to certain privileges, according to his quality and condition of life, with a proportional sum of money out of a fund appropriated for that use. He likewise acquires the title of Snilpall, or legal, which is added to his name, but doth not descend to his posterity. And these people thought it a prodigious deficit of policy among us when I told them that our laws were enforced only by penalties, without any mention of reward. It is upon this account that the image of justice in their courts of judicature is formed with six eyes, two before, as many behind, and on each side one, to signify circumspection, with a bag of gold open in her right hand and a sword sheathed in her left, to show she is more disposed to reward than to punishment. In choosing persons for all employments, they have more regard to good morals than to great abilities, for since government is necessary to mankind, they believe that the common size of human understanding is fitted to some station or other, and that Providence never intended to make the management of public affairs a mystery to be comprehended only by a few persons of sublime genius, of which there seldom are three born in an age. But they suppose truth, justice, temperance, and the like to be in every man's power, the practice of which virtues, assisted by experience and good intention, would qualify any man for the service of his country, except where a course of study is required. But they thought the want of moral virtues was so far from being supplied by the superior endowments of the mind, that employments could never be put into such dangerous hands as those of persons so qualified, and at least that the mistakes committed by ignorance in a virtuous disposition would never be of such fatal consequence to the public weal as the practices of a man whose inclinations led him to be corrupt and had great abilities to manage, to manipulate, and defend his corruptions. In like manner, the disbelief of a divine providence renders a man incapable of holding any public station. For since kings avow themselves to be the deputies of Providence, the Lilliputians think nothing can be more absurd than for a prince to employ such men as disown the authority under which he acteth. In relating these and the following laws, I would only be understood to mean the original institutions, and not the most scandalous corruptions into which these people are fallen by the degenerate nature of man. For as to that infamous practice of acquiring great employments by dancing on the ropes, or badges of favor and distinction by leaping over sticks and creeping under them, the reader is to observe that they were first introduced by the grandfather of the emperor now reigning, and grew to the present height by the gradual increase of party and faction. Ingratitude is among them a capital crime, as we read it to have been in some other countries. For they reason thus, that whoever makes ill returns to his benefactor must needs be a common enemy to the rest of mankind, for whom he hath received no obligation, and therefore such a man is not fit to live. Their notions relating to the duties of parents and children differ extremely from ours, for since the conjunction of male and female is found upon the great law of nature in order to propagate and continue the species, the Lilliputians will needs have it that men and women are joined together like other animals by the motives of concupiscence, and that their tenderness towards their young proceedeth from the like natural principle. For which reason they will never allow that a child is under any obligation to his father for begetting him, or to his mother for bringing him into the world, which, considering the miseries of human life, was neither a benefit in itself nor intended so by his parents, whose thoughts in their love encounters were otherwise employed. Upon these and the like reasonings, their opinion is that parents are the last of all others to be trusted with the education of their own children, and therefore they have in every town public nurseries, where all parents, except cottagers and laborers, are obliged to send their infants of both sexes to be reared and educated when they come to the age of 20 moons, at which time they are supposed to have some rudiments of docility. These schools are of several kinds, suited to different qualities and to both sexes. They have certain professors well skilled in preparing children for such a condition of life as befits the rank of their parents and their own capacities as well as inclinations. I shall first say something of the male nurseries, and then of the female. The nurseries for males of noble or eminent birth are provided with grave and learned professors and their several deputies. The clothes and food of the children are plain and simple. They are bred up in principles of honor, justice, courage, modesty, clemency, religion, and love of their country. They are always employed in some business, except in times of eating and sleeping, which are very short, and 2 hours for diversions consisting of bodily exercises. They are dressed by men until 4 years of age, and then are obliged to dress themselves, although their quality be ever so great. And the women attendants, who are aged proportionably to ours at 50, perform only the most menial offices. They are never suffered to converse with servants, but go together in small or great numbers to take their diversions, and always in the presence of a professor or one of his deputies, whereby they avoid those early bad impressions of folly and vice to which our children are subject. Their parents are suffered to see them only twice a year, and the visit is not to last above an hour. They are allowed to kiss the child at meeting and parting, but a professor, who always standeth by on those occasions, will not suffer them to whisper or use any fondling expressions or bring any presents of toys, sweetmeats, and the like. The pension from each family for the education and entertainment of a child upon failure of due payment is levied by the emperor's officers. The nurseries for children of ordinary gentlemen, merchants, traders, and handicrafts are managed proportionably after the same manner. Only those designed for trades are put out apprentices at 7 years old, whereas those of persons of quality continue in their exercises until 15, which answers to 21 with us. But the confinement is gradually lessened for the last 3 years. In the female nurseries, the young girls of quality are educated much like the males, only they are dressed by orderly servants of their own sex, but always in the presence of a professor or deputy, until they come to dress themselves, which is at 5 years old. And if it be found that these nurses ever presume to entertain the girls with frightful or foolish stories, or the common follies practiced by chambermaids among us, they are publicly whipped thrice about the city, imprisoned for a year, and banished for life to the most desolate parts of the country. Thus, the young ladies there are as much ashamed of being cowards and fools as the men, and despise all personal ornaments beyond decency and clemency. Neither did I perceive any difference in their education made by their difference of sex, only that the exercises of the females were not altogether so robust, and that some rules were given them relating to domestic life, and a smaller compass of learning was enjoined by them. For their maxim is that among people of quality, a wife should be always a reasonable and agreeable companion, because she cannot always be young. When the girls are 12 years old, which among them is the marriageable age, their parents or guardians take them home with great expressions of gratitude to the professors and sell them without tears of the young ladies and her companions. In the nurseries of females of the meaner sort, the children are instructed in all kinds of works proper for their sex and their several degrees. Those intended for apprentices are dismissed at 7 years old, the rest are kept to 11. The meaner families who have children at these nurseries are obliged, besides their annual pension, which is as low as possible, to return to the steward of the nursery a small monthly share of their gettings to be a portion for the child, and therefore all parents are limited in their expenses by the law. For the Lilliputians think that nothing can be more unjust than that people, in subservience to their own appetites, should bring children into the world and leave the burden of supporting them on the public. As to persons of quality, they give security to appropriate a certain sum for each child suitable to their condition, and these funds are always managed with good husbandry and the most exact justice. The cottagers and laborers keep their children at home, their business being only to till and cultivate the earth, and therefore their education is of little consequence to the public. But the old and diseased among them are supported by hospitals, for begging is a trade unknown in this empire. And here it may perhaps divert the curious reader to give some account of my domestic and my manner of living in this country during a residence of 9 months and 13 days. Having a head mechanically turned, and being likewise forced by necessity, I had made myself a table and chair convenient enough out of the largest trees in the royal park. 200 sempstresses were employed to make me shirts and linen for my bed and table, all of the strongest and coarsest kind they could get, which, however, they were forced to quilt together in several folds, for the thickest was some degrees finer than lawn. Their linen is usually 3 inches wide and 3 foot make a piece. The sempstresses took my measure as I lay on the ground, one standing at my neck and another at my mid-leg with a strong cord extended that each held by the end, while the third measured the length of the cord with a rule of an inch long. Then they measured my right thumb and desired no more, for by a mathematical computation that twice round the thumb is once round the wrist, and so on to the neck and the waist, and by the help of my old shirt which I displayed on the ground before them for a pattern, they fitted me exactly. 300 tailors were employed in the same manner to make me clothes, but they had another contrivance for taking my measure. I kneeled down, and they raised a ladder from the ground to my neck. Upon this ladder, one of them mounted and let fall a plumb line from my collar to the floor, which just answered the length of my coat. But my waist and arms I measured myself. When my clothes were finished, which was done in my house, for the largest of theirs would not have been able to hold them, they looked like the patchwork made by the ladies in England, only that mine were all of a color. I had 300 cooks to dress my victuals in little convenient huts built by my house, where they and their families lived and prepared me 2 dishes apiece. I took up 20 waiters in my hand and placed them on the table, and 100 more attended below on the ground, some with dishes of meat, and some with barrels of wine and other liquors slung on their shoulders, all which the waiters above drew up as I wanted in a very ingenious manner by certain cords as we draw the bucket up a well in Europe. A dish of their meat was a good mouthful, and a barrel of their liquor a reasonable draught. Their mutton yields to ours, but their beef is excellent. I have had a sirloin so large that I have been forced to make 3 bits of it, but this is rare. My servants were astonished to see me eat it, bones and all, as in our country we do the leg of a lark. Their geese and turkeys I usually eat at a mouthful, and I must confess they far exceed ours. Of their smaller fowl, I could take up 20 or 30 at the end of my knife. One day, His Imperial Majesty, being informed of my way of living, desired that himself and his royal consort, with the young princes of the blood of both sexes, might have the happiness, as he was pleased to call it, of dining with me. They came accordingly, and I placed them upon chairs of state on my table, just over against me, with their guards about them. Flimnap, the Lord High Treasurer, attended there likewise with his white staff, and I observed he often looked on me with a sour countenance, which I would not seem to regard, but eat more than usual in honor to my dear country, as well as to fill the court with admiration. I have some private reason to believe that this visit from His Majesty gave Flimnap an opportunity of doing me ill office to his master. That minister had always been my secret enemy, although he outwardly caressed me more than was usual to the moroseness of his nature. He represented to the emperor the low condition of his treasury, that he was forced to take up money at great discount, that exchequer bills would not circulate under 9% below par, that I had cost His Majesty about 1.5 million of sprugs, their greatest gold coin about the bigness of a spangle, and upon the whole, that it would be advisable in the emperor to take the first fair occasion of dismissing me. I am here obliged to vindicate the reputation of an excellent lady, who was an innocent sufferer upon my account. The treasurer took a fancy to be jealous of his wife from the malice of some evil tongues, who informed him that her grace had taken a violent affection for my person, and the court scandal ran for some time that she once came privately to my lodging. This I solemnly declare to be a most infamous falsehood without any grounds farther than that her grace was pleased to treat me with all innocent marks of freedom and friendship. I own she came often to my house, but always publicly, nor ever without 3 more in the coach, who were usually her sister and young daughter and some particular acquaintance. But this was common to many other ladies of the court. And I still appeal to my servants round whether they at any time saw a coach at my door without knowing what person were in it. On those occasions when a servant had given me notice, my custom was to go immediately to the door, and after paying my respects, to take up the coach and 2 horses very carefully in my hands, for if there were 6 horses, the postillion always unharnessed 4, and place them on a table, where I had fixed a movable rim quite round of 5 inches high to prevent accidents. And I have often had 4 coaches and a horse at once on my table full of company, whilst I sat in my chair leaning my face towards them. And when I was engaged with 1 set, the coachman would gently drive the others round my table. I have passed many an afternoon very agreeably in these conditions, but I defy the treasurer or his 2 informers, I will name them and let them make their best of it, Clustrill and Drunlow, to prove that any person ever came to me incognito, except the secretary Reldrassol, who was sent by express command of His Imperial Majesty, as I have before related. I should not have dwelt so long upon this particular if it had not been a point wherein the reputation of a great lady is so nearly concerned, to say nothing of my own. Although I had the honor of being a Nardac, which the treasurer himself is not, for all the world knows he is only a Clumglum, a title inferior by 1 degree as that of a marquis is to a duke in England, yet I allow he preceded me in right of his post. These false informations, which I afterward came to the knowledge of by an accident not proper to mention, made the treasurer show his lady for some time an ill countenance, and me a worse. For although he were at last undeceived and reconciled to her, yet I lost all credit with him, and found my interest decline very fast with the emperor himself, who was indeed too much governed by that favorite.
All right. I don't think that I have to tell you how many different illustrations you can find of Gulliver urinating on the Queen's side of the palace. I will give you a modest example on the show notes of 2 which were suppressed from later editions. They're not, you know, graphic or anything, but he is clearly relieving himself on the palace, which cracks me up. And you knew it was coming, right? And if you saw the Jack Black version, right? It's fantastic. And it's the part that everybody's always like, well, that couldn't possibly have been in the book. Oh, yes. Yes, yes. Actually, it is. Lots of peeing. Oh, dear. Now, the whole Empress getting ticked off at Gulliver for doing that, actually probably has some relationship to real history. There is some, I don't know how valid, discussion about this Gulliver putting out the fire being a symbol for the Tories putting out the fire of the war through the treaty, the much disputed treaty that Bolingbroke and Oxford got, the Treaty of Utrecht. That may or may not be, I don't know. But Swift did in fact fall out of favor with Queen Anne towards the end of her reign. And the reason was he wrote this book, The Tale of a Tub, which was very clever. It was a very clever symbolic satire, piece of satire, where he upheld the Church of England against attack by the Catholics on the right and dissenters on the left. His satire was so clever, and Queen Anne not so clever, that she actually thought he was being irreligious and kind of coarse, because his language was a little on the vulgar side. And the same way that the Lilliputian queen is offended by the urine that is being used to save her palace. But after that, Queen Anne was not a fan of Swift's. And it's one of the reasons that his advancement in his work didn't happen. She kind of saw to it that he didn't move along. Did you catch the line back in chapter 5? I would never be an instrument of bringing a free and brave people into slavery. Wow. Gulliver refusing to enslave the people of Blefuscu. That's an interesting statement to make. And of course, taken out of context, you could use it to promote all sorts of forward thinking at the time. I just remember that the first time I listened to the book, that line jumped out at me and I thought, who is this guy? Swift is so way ahead of his time. And then at the same time, you know, he gets a few digs in at women. I love that the reason that the fire started was because one of the lady's maids fell asleep while reading a romance, which is, you know, Swift's way of saying, you know, Gulliver's story, this adventure story, that wouldn't have put you to sleep, but reading a romance, boy, did you make a mistake. And look what you have to pay for it. So that was kind of, I thought that was kind of silly. And then, too, he does make another dig at the ladies later where he's talking about the way the Lilliputians write, you know, not from the right to the left or the left to the right or up or down, nor a slant from one corner of the paper to the other like the ladies in England. Now, I have read that the assumption is that he's just making fun of women and the fact that they don't write as well as men. And that may be true. Certainly women didn't have access to the same education as women, something that he then goes along to point out later in chapter 6. But I also remember, even when we were doing penmanship, there were always some girls in the class, and it was always girls, who would turn their papers kind of sideways, kind of on a diagonal, and write. And if the paper was forced to be straight up and down, they would actually write on a diagonal. And part of it was because of the way that they were holding their hand and how much work they were putting into making their letters beautiful. So now I'm kind of curious if that's just, is that just a thing? Is that like hardwired? Is that something about our physiology and the way our hands work? I have no idea, but I thought it was so cute. Do you guys remember that? Do you remember girls doing, were you the girl doing that? I don't know. Anyway, once Swift gets into the law and the punishment situation in Lilliput, he is starting to make some very decided links towards his own people and his own time. When he talks about people being put to an ignominious death for crimes against the state, this is that kind of, you know, kind of the House Un-American Activities Committee type of thing. But there was something else that had happened not too long before Swift was writing it. Certainly it would have been within his sphere of discussion. There was a guy named Titus Oates, who in 1678 fabricated a quote-unquote popish plot, that ended in the execution of 35 innocent Catholics. So because he lied about what these people weren't doing, because they didn't do it, he wound up getting them all killed. Now, in Lilliput, that would be a bad thing. And he would get in serious, serious trouble for that. So Swift had plenty of stuff from his day to draw on to make these parallels to. Then he also has these little kind of utopian fantasies that, you know, if somebody can prove that they obeyed all the laws for so many moons, then they get a special title. You know, it's kind of sweet. And it's very Gulliver to be impressed by something like that, which is, it's kind of adorable. And then there is this curious bit where he's talking about the morality and the practice of virtues, the practice of which virtues, assisted by experience and good intention, would qualify any man for the service of his country, except where a course of study is required. But they thought the want of moral virtues was so far from being supplied by superior endowments of the mind, being smart, that employments could never be put into such dangerous hands as those of persons so qualified. You couldn't put those jobs into the hands of smart people. And at least that the mistakes committed by ignorance in a virtuous disposition would never be of such fatal consequence to the public weal as the practices of a man whose inclinations led him to be corrupt and had great abilities to manage, to multiply, and to defend his corruptions. Now, this is being said by Jonathan Swift, who is a very smart man. And it's a really interesting argument. And this is what I'm putting up as our Twitter question for the week. Where do you think Swift was going with this particular statement? Because he's making a point. He's making a very interesting point. And is he making the point he meant to make? Ha ha. So, tweet away. And you, if you go to the craftlit.com page, you'll see the Twitter feed and you'll be able to watch what people are saying. Now, were you shocked by the way the Lilliputians raise their children? Does that remind you of any book you read in 7th, 8th, 9th grade? Brave New World, maybe? I was stupefied when we got to this part. The kids being taken out of the home and put into the nurseries. Wow. Wow. And hey, women get an education here. That's just, I don't know what came before this that Swift was drawing on, but I do know this. Swift had two women in his life. I don't think he ever married either of them. I need to check on that. He had two women, his wife, both of them clearly very bright women. And they had, from what I can piece together, kind of a Wilkie Collins-esque relationship way back in the early 1700s. He was definitely forward-thinking in some respects and a product of his time in other respects. But at least in his writing, he was willing to entertain stuff like this. I mean, he's way far ahead of the conventional wisdom of the time. It was just, wow. Just so you didn't misunderstand, when he talks about people of the meaner sort, he's not talking about nasty people or mean people. The usage of that term used to be common. And of course, all of the horrible things that rich people would associate with the commoners, that's what winds up getting associated with the word mean by our time. But back then, back in the day, it just meant common. Just like the vulgar, it's the same thing. It's just it's the people. It's the common people. It's only later that the words start to take on negative connotations. And of course, lest you be too impressed by Swift, he doesn't seem to think that it's important to educate the peasants because, you know, all they're doing is growing the food. Which, of course, cracks me up because anybody who doesn't have a green thumb, join me in awe of farmers. I would be very hungry if I had to rely on myself for my own food all the time. And that's that leads us up to the end where poor Gulliver had to vindicate the reputation of an excellent lady because people were accusing them of having an affair. All right, Gulliver is 12 times her size. And I'll stop there because that's really all you need to know. And it's the earnestness with which he defends his situation and her situation that is so, so Gulliver. He's just so sweet. And it's just, okay, that's funny. I like that. And of course, his the word that he comes up, he's the Nardak. Gulliver's the Nardak. But Flimnap, who's Roger Walpole, Flimnap is only a clum-glum. I can totally see Lewis Carroll having read Jonathan Swift before he starts to write Alice in Wonderland, because some of the words that Jonathan Swift comes up with are just so perfectly evocative. I love it. There is also, by the way, a factual basis for the affair paradigm here, because Walpole, who Flimnap, who Swift is making fun of, his wife was rumored to have been having an affair. The interesting thing is that Walpole didn't seem to give a flying leap at a rolling donut. He couldn't have cared less, which seems odd, but, you know, it's hard to know what goes on in the hearts of men, especially 400 years later. But that sets you up. Now you can really see how Swift is constructing his satire. He gives you those introductory chapters to get you used to the culture, and then he's going to move you into more and more direct satire as we head through the rest of this book. And each chapter highlights a different part of his world that is flawed. Don't forget, if you subscribe to the show this weekend, you will start to get your new cool bits. I am so excited. Audiobooks, audio patterns, all that stuff. Wensleydale will be up. I don't know if I'll get it up on the show notes for this episode. I'll give it a shot. But it will definitely be up for everybody next week, if not sooner. And Madame Defarge Political Action Committee t-shirt. Donate. Get put in the running. Don't forget to visit audiblepodcast.com/craftlit for your free trial and free book. And on that note, I leave you. I hope you have a great week. I hope I do too. And I hope these chapters give you a few good giggles. Some bigger than others. All right. Have a good one. Bye. There are many ways to listen to Craftlit. You can listen on your smartphone via the Stitcher Radio app. You can subscribe free through iTunes, or you can download and listen to the iPhone, iTouch, and Android app, where you'll receive occasional extras for the show. Craftlit is supported in a number of ways. Knit Circus, the free e-newsletter featuring three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can find out more at knitcircus.com. Also, the What Would Madame Defarge Knit series, Volume 2, What Else Would Madame Defarge Knit, is now in pre-orders. You can find out more from the links in the show notes at craftlit.com. Little Acorn Creations, handmade accessories from the heart and home. And Seed Pod Publishing, a micro-publisher cooperative publishing books not for their value as products, but for their value. Any questions? Craftlit is made possible by the generous support of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. If you would like to help support the show, please know there are various ways to donate, and all of them help keep Craftlit and Just the Books free and available to you whenever you feel the need for a good story. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.